This is The Conversation, episode number 107. Christian Viveros Faunet returns. I'm Michael Shaw. Welcome to the show. The website for the show is theconversationpod.com. Thank you for being here. Well, I have Christian back. He was on the show about 7 months ago, and it turns out that he became the most popular episode of this podcast by a wide margin. So I thought it might be great to have him back, not only because of that, but because, you know, he's a great guest. The most intriguing guests, as far as the conversation goes, seem to have been writers slash critics for the most part. So with an occasional dealer sprinkled in. But you love this conversation by your numbers, and I thought I would revisit it. So, and it ended up being a really good one. I think the fact that we had one under our belt made us that much more comfortable and get into the flow and, you know, cover a lot of stuff about the art world, as you will see. More on that in a minute. Now, can I take a minute and speak to you, host, to listener? Okay, good. I wanted to show some appreciation for a string of recent donations and feedback that I've gotten. Starting with, let's see, well, we could talk about this year so far. We've got Jeffrey Morris, who has donated before, donate again. LA artist Sydney Croskery donated. Judy Tabel, Zhao Zhu from New York, I believe one of the only New York donation recently. Katie Herzog of Los Angeles, who also has given me some interesting feedback. Chilla Sadlock of Pennsylvania. Very nice donation and very, very enthusiastic feedback. Thank you to her. Ethan Johnson of Los Angeles, both feedback and donation. Lisa Gold, donation and some very intriguing thoughts about the show. And most recently, Archie of Richmond, California, through a shell fund, apparently, Center Star Manufacturing. No, it's his business. And showed his support as well as the donation. So I wanted to just take a minute and address all of you who I have not heard from, particularly those of you in the New York area, New York City area, being that I'm sure that Christian's last episode was listened to by a large number. This is, we're talking several thousand downloads for that episode, close to 10,000. And I know a number of you are in the New York City area, and the only one of you in New York that I've heard from is a donation from the dealer, Zach Foyer, about a year and a half or 2 years ago. Other than that, haven't heard from any of you in New York. I know you got a lot of texting to do as you're walking down the street, but I would really appreciate, here's the thing I'd like to say to those of you in the New York City area, but also everyone else who I have not heard from. This is a listener-supported show. It's a one-man operation at this point. I'm trying to line up another intern. I had one for a few months, trying to line up another one. And, you know, I obviously put a lot into this. Time-wise, I have to pay for the database that hosts all the episodes. That's the biggest part of the budget ongoing. It's not huge, but, you know, with the modest amount of donations I get, it's, you know, I really don't even keep in the black. I'm really in the red. So think of this as me getting up on a scissor lift and shaking the Bodhi tree that includes you, the listener, and calling you to action to... So basically what I'm trying to get you to do is either donate even a modest amount. That's a way of showing your appreciation. You don't have to write a single word. You just donate. That'd be great. And or if you could just take a minute or two and write an email and say, hey, I'm in New York. I'm in Chicago. I'm in Atlanta. I'm in London. I listen to this show and I appreciate it. That's all you have to say. That's all I ultimately want at this juncture. Of course, I would like a little bit more funding and connections to an angel investor, but that is a great start. So if you would be so kind as to do as so many of these generous people that I mentioned have done and make a modest donation and give some feedback, I would really appreciate it. All right, so let's get to the episode with Christian Viveros Fauné. And let me just say before we get there that we did talk about the Cuban artist Tania Bruguera, and I, when I first mentioned her, called her Sonia Bruguera, and that is probably because the only other Bruguera I know of is the tennis player Sergi Bruguera. So Sergi, Sonia, Tania. I apologize, mea culpa. And other than that, let's talk briefly on the back end about why you think Christian Viveros Fauné was the most popular, and hopefully this episode will follow suit. And one last thing before we get into the conversation, just want to let you know that we are in mid-conversation about Christian's social media presence. A mutual friend of ours has suggested that he needs to get on that. We talk about that and the pros and cons. So here we go. Thank you very much for being here.
Semi-part-time job for me, man. Get on social media.
I hear you. You know, if you don't need to do it, I personally don't agree with her assessment at this juncture. If things change, it could be a different scenario. But right now, you know, if you're not missing it, why?
Yeah, well, that's just it, and I'm not.
Yeah, so, there you go.
You know,
yeah.
And I feel somehow also, honestly, slightly protected by it. You know, I just, like you, like a lot of people who are in this trade, you know, fuck any trade, you know, you want to be generous to folks, but if your door is always open, man, then your door is always opening, you know, guess what's going to happen?
Yeah.
You get a lot of uninvited people coming in asking you for stuff.
Interesting. Right. That's an interesting way of looking at it. I thought you were also kind of going in the direction of, you know, one false tweet and your career is sunk.
Well, there's that too.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
There's that too. And you know, I'm actually more interested in Instagram or even twittering than I am in Facebook. You know, because it seems to be, well, neither of them are really one way communication, but I don't know, just less time consuming.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
140 characters is an argument, and I can't imagine having an argument over just, well, actually, yes, I can. But it makes it harder to sort of get a, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, to get involved, to get in a fight.
Yeah.
You'd think. Who knows?
Well, it's great to have you back, and I'm going to start by buttering you up, but with facts, if that's okay. Your episode on this podcast is the most popular episode thus far.
Seriously? That's hard to believe. I don't know what people are smoking.
It is surprising considering that the people that you've left in the dust are very social media active. So it is a mystery, but I guess it speaks to maybe the finite nature of social media in some contexts, and maybe also to your combination of journalism and, you know, gallery history.
Yeah, you know, God forbid it should be some function of people wanting some kind of not being so available, creating some kind of extra interest. I don't know, you know, mystery or something. Who knows, man?
Yeah,
I can't really. I'm no expert as you know, at reading those tea leaves, the tea leaves of social media, but you know, whatever. Look, I'm glad that people tuned in, and I'm glad that people appreciated it.
Yeah,
if that's what they did. So,
well, it's occurred to me that in having you back, you know, and giving the people what they want, I want to revisit this as we start talking more about MoMA and what they've been doing, because I thought there might be an interesting parallel there. I think MoMA and some of their shows and you know, are maybe is in fact a good place to start. I know you've been writing a lot about the situation with Havana and Sonia Bruguera recently, and we can get to those as well. But maybe if we could start by framing it, the recent pieces you've done. Actually, you know what? I'm gonna pull back for a second, because one thing that I realized in reading several of your pieces is that you are taking a longer form approach, that being a combination of reporting and reviewing. You know, and when you're reviewing, you're integrating your reviews with reporting. And I'm just wondering if, you have are fully cognizant of that decision, and that the sort of the non-contextual review is something that you are no longer interested in, or if you were ever interested in the first place.
I don't think I was ever really interested in a non-contextual review. I think there is a difference, though, between the two MoMA-related pieces that we're going to talk about, or that I imagine we're going to talk about.
Yeah.
I mean, one is the piece I wrote for The Voice, Harper Now Show, and that's, you know, straight up a review. I don't need to find quotes for that. I don't need to find sources for that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not breaking any news. All that material is out there, but I've always sort of insisted in reviewing and providing context, because context is everything with art or with anything else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just not the same glass of water if it's at the MoMA and it's got an artist's signature on it than it is at your table. And, you know, that can make for radically different interpretations. Far more important things like, you know, amounts of money spent, or kind of a career a given artist has, or the new people that, you know, maybe a certain museum board has brought on. I mean, all those things can impact significantly on a show at an institution, you know, and I think this should be brought up. On the other hand, I think that the piece I did for ArtNet News, the Biesenbach piece, you know, was all about sort of breaking news and finding sources. So I do think there's a distinction between the two. I mean, I see it. I hope everybody else does. But my reviews have always wanted to provide context, whether it's historical context or something else, you know, because,
right,
you know, because it fleshes things out. You know, and I also want to sort of insist on being able to, you know, have, I don't know, say, Lawrence Weiner or something else that basically is very sort of in club in terms of the art world. I want to insist on making that available to people who are lay folk, you know, who are not necessarily in the club. And part of the way you do that is providing context.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, in mentioning in passing the board members and whatnot, one larger question as well that I wanted to sort of get into is, you know, you wrote this recent piece about the new Whitney, which was very complimentary. There's not kind of a lot we can talk about there, because it was, you know, you like the building, you like the introductory shows for the most part. I just wonder, and then, you know, all these issues with MoMA, I just wonder if, I know you don't have a horse in the race, but I wonder if on some level there is a frustration with the power structure at MoMA that's so messed up versus the Whitney, which is much more as it should be, or something along those lines.
Yeah, you know, who knows in terms of the actual boards? I mean, you know, I know a little about the MoMA board. I don't know that much about the Whitney board. But I see what you're getting at. And you know, a funny thing is that a friend of mine, a dealer in Copenhagen, actually sort of called me up as I was writing the Whitney piece, and said that actually after it had come out and someone had read it, commented to him that it felt like every sort of like hand given to the Whitney felt like a bit slapped to MoMA, which, you know, I certainly hadn't intended to. That wasn't my thinking at the time, but, you know, I think sort of across the board, that's one way to read, or that's one potential reading of a lot of the love that was thrown the Whitney's way. I think that what the Whitney did this time around, I think this is actually good stuff to talk about. You know, I mean, hopefully we don't just have a conversation, or, you know, get interested when, you know, somebody sort of like, you know, does the critical equivalent of a, no, you didn't. What the Whitney did right is, you know, what one hopes, you know, more museums would do right. I mean, in a number of ways, as I talked about in the article, but the main one being that, like, well, two main ones being that the building itself is like really, really friendly to art, which is rare.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
You know, even if you have real questions about the, you know, expansion at any cost sort of ethos of art museums these days, and I have a lot of issues with that. This was a building that deserved to be built, and mm-hmm. It's really kind of art. You know, it's the it's the opposite. It's the diametrical opposite of Bilbao. And aside from that, you know, clearly the Whitney had, you know, I don't know if they had a full year, but it felt like they had a year to actually think through a show. And it show, you know, and not to be redundant, but it shows. It's a really thoughtful show. It's a difficult show to put together. They could have really, you know, messed up in so many different ways. And it's, you know, not only worth seeing, man, but it's like worth seeing like 2-3 times.
Wow.
You know, I haven't been back since I made it the first time, but I have every intention of going back at least one more time. It kind of felt like the Met, you know, which is, it kind of gave you that feeling that you get when you go to an encyclopedic museum where you see 2 or 3 things at most, right? At most, you spend a whole afternoon or a whole morning, and you walk away having the sense that, you know, you just took in a small bite, you know? So, yeah, so I think that's a difference. I mean, you know, look, I think it's important to say that MoMA has also been doing good shows while they've been doing really crappy shows.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
In fact, I wrote about one for The Voice. In fact, a week after the ArtNet news piece was published about Biesenbach & Co., they rehung their permanent collection. Literally, the entrance to that show, to the new rehang, is like steps away from the atrium, which is where, you know, the ridiculous Bjork show is. They did a really good job of it. You know, and it was a number of departmental curators that put that together. So, you know, clearly with an institution like MoMA is huge. It's like the government, man.
Mm.
You know, so there's a lot of things happening at once.
Right.
You know, so there's no sense in painting them all as a mess, because it's not, that's just not true. It's not the case. A few of these curators, I think five different departments, put together just a really, really good show, a thinking show of work done within the last 5 years that was stuff that was in the collection and that, you know, most of it, you know, had not been seen.
Mm-hmm. Well, even given the size, as you put it, like the government of the institution, do you see any through line or any continuity between the debacle with the real estate, you know, and the Craft and Folk Museum and all of that, and the curatorial sort of craziness with Biesenbach,
yeah,
and what
I
have
do.
You? You do.
Do,
yeah.
You know, I think, you know, in terms of, I mean, again, as we go back to the government analogy, they're the bureaucrats, and they're the chiefs of staff, as it were, or the elected officials, and they're and their ministers, and they've been sort of viewing a very expansionist, you know, very entertainment friendly line, you know, I'd say significantly sort of anti-art line, almost anti-intellectual, and that's been the stuff that's gotten them the most popularity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, they shunted a lot of the permanent collection up to like the top floors. It's no longer the star of the show at the institution. That's really what you used to go see, you know, if you're a tourist, or you came with your parents, or, you know, you came from wherever it was, Boise, Detroit, Miami, Durham, North Carolina, you pulled into New York, and, you know, one of the first things obviously you do is you go to the MoMA, and you go, why? Because you go to see their collection of modernism. Now that collection of modernism is, to say it's not primary is a significant understatement.
Mm-hmm,
you
mm-hmm.
know, what they're one of the problems that MoMA's had institutionally, sort of since the last decade or so, is trying to figure out where to go next. You know, partly because there's a lot of money in it, and partly because the institution needs another mission, and it needs to sort of figure out the contemporary. They got to that a little later than other institutions. They certainly got to it a lot later than, say, for example, the Tate did.
Mm-hmm.
And in trying to grasp that new mission, you know, they've fumbled quite a bit, and they've almost inscribed celebrity as some sort of new avant-garde, which is super problematic
mm-hmm.
in just about every single way, you know, and that's where sort of like someone like Klaus Biesenbach comes in.
Well, good segue, because I think we should go ahead and get to that, and then the Forever Now show. So you, in these two different pieces, the one, as you mentioned before, of the Forever Now, more of a straight review, the one with Biesenbach, much more reportorial and, in depth, and a lot of behind the scenes. And you characterize Klaus Biesenbach as this star fucker, basically. And one thing that I want to get to before I forget is that in thinking about this Bjork show that he put on, you know, that apparently Beyond You has met with a lot of critical hate. When you put on a show like that at MoMA, taking up this very important time of the year for a very important length of time or very long period, it occurred to me that not only is that embarrassing potentially to the museum, but it's shutting out a show that then shuts out other shows, and that's like a trickle down throughout the art community, throughout the art world.
Michael, I don't think you couldn't be more right. I mean, the thing is, if you give Bjork a show, I mean, let's leave aside the fact that the show's a disaster, and that's really the reason why I think everybody objected to it. I personally think there's a real question to be put to Biesenbach in the museum whether, you know, Bjork deserves a show. I don't think she does. You know, I mean, she didn't change music. David Bowie deserves a show, but Bjork, frankly, I'm not so sure. And if so, probably not at MoMA.
Yeah.
But look, every time you give her or Tilda Swinton or, you know, somebody else who's a friend of Klaus's or is, you know, simply a celebrity, room in the museum, you're absolutely right, man. You're depriving an artist of the same space and the same time slot. You know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what's a museum for, really, is sort of the question.
Yeah.
You know, is it a tourist attraction straight up, or is this art that can also be sort of friendly to, among other folks, tourists?
Right.
And that's a defining question for an institution like MoMA right now.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, most of their decisions seem to be about money and the gate. And celebrity plays a big part in that. You know, it's the true and tried way to sort of bring people into, you know, Universal Studios and other sort of complexes.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, the MoMA's, I guess, sort of figuring, well, why not?
Right. You really made me, getting to Biesenbach in another context, the Marina Abramović, the Artist is Present show, you know, and I saw that documentary, and it's sort of this... somewhat of a climax where he's sitting down with her, you know, at the table. And apparently, based on the way you describe what actually happened, the film neglected to include the lividness that she was apparently, or surprise that she was apparently experiencing, because he cut off the official time that she had planned at the end of his performance.
And like a lot of her performances, you know, they're really sort of like timed to the second.
Mm-hmm.
The film cut that off, and they also obviously sort of cut off the dinner and party afterwards.
Right.
Disaster.
Yeah.
Listen, in fact, there was some questioning as to whether I'd gotten that right. And, you know, I was pretty sure I'd gotten it right because I got it from people who were very close to the institution. But I got it from somebody who was very close to her a couple of weeks ago, sort of sat me down and said, you were absolutely right.
Oh, good.
You know, I had to actually walk her outside to get air because she was ready to kill him. And, you know, the accurate narrative is that effectively happened.
Mm-hmm.
And that she was tremendously displeased.
Yeah. Well, this is an interesting contrast to the conversation I had with, a hyperallergic writer a year or so ago about the show, because there was a certain amount of schadenfreude at the time, you know, because of her institution that she was building and whatnot.
Right.
You know, her persona and brand, you know, was getting a little out of control. So maybe this is like a step forward for her that she was slighted in her own show by this guy who, you know, yeah.
Well, I mean, who knows? Abramović is also sort of a weird character, a weird sort of like construct in and of herself. You know, she's sort of taken this celebrity thing and run with it in her own sort of semi-art-worldly direction. And, you know, I don't know if you saw the news recently, but or just today or yesterday. I mean, they're ridiculous. And they're really only funny to sort of comment on, but, you know, she apparently she was very angry and said so in some interview in Brazil about the fact that Jay-Z had not kicked in money to her institute after, you know, essentially sort of using or I'd say like parroting her performance in that Picasso Baby video.
Right. That's
and then it turns out and then it turns out the next day, you know, he did. He has the receipt number.
Yeah, that was actually one of the video was the reason that this writer and I were talking about Abramovich, because it was this whole star fucking thing, you know. So here we are back at Biesenbach again. So that's something that the two of them share apparently, and now you're saying that maybe the whole reason that she did that was so she could get a substantial check for her institute.
Well, you know, that was one of the reasons. I mean, right. I think star fucking is another basic reason, as you sort of pointed out.
I
think, you know, everyone's just sort of like, that's the point of conformism these days, you know, at least one of them. It's money and star fucking. And people are sort of very naturally gravitating to that, you know. You know, it's sort of, some of it's, you got to think of these things as natural to some degree, otherwise you lose your fucking mind.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if you figure, you know, a lot of folks don't have their own ideas about, you know, the way that the world works, the art world works, or values in general, you know, money and star fucking are available, and they're there, and they're out in the news all the time. And it's natural that people basically sort of go to it like moths to flames. So.
Yeah, and we could go on about that because it's reminding me of the Miami and another conversation I had with an art advisor who was talking about sort of the mix of fashion and art that was going on, which, you know, is another sort of unsettling phenomenon.
Yeah.
But let's not get into that. We don't need to give them any more column inches. But let's talk about Forever Now show. Because I think there are a lot of interesting, more art-specific things going on here, and I guess since you in one, you know, in less than a sentence, can write off the show by referring to Oscar Murillo's inclusion in it. Why don't we talk about him for a second? I unfortunately have not had the opportunity, if you will, of seeing his work in person, so I can't weigh in, you know, as a. Any kind of pundit per se, but I did, just to play a little devil's advocate, I did have a conversation with an artist in a fairly recent episode who saw the show and thought his work held up. And I, you know, I don't think she's, you know, overburdened by, you know, the critical preview to that phenomenon. So I'm just wondering if that's something that you are at all familiar with, you know, from people you respect at all.
You know, everyone is entitled to their own opinion, and I'm sure your friend is both smart and obviously, I think, charitable. But I've not had a conversation with a single painter or critic that thinks, that really genuinely thinks that Oscar Murillo's work is anything but like pap.
Yeah.
You know, and essentially sort of an art world hot air balloon.
Right.
Just pumped up from the very beginning by a group of collectors. You know, it's unfortunate to say because he's a young artist, and you know, you want to wish young artists the best, man. But in a way, sort of like going after him or going after his work, rather, is really you know, a lot more about going after people like the Rebels, frankly.
Yeah.
And the McGravies and folks who you know, overnight decide to pump young, untried artists like him and, you know, float him to the moon. I just don't think he had any place in that show. I mean, that his being in that show just totally disqualified it for me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there were plenty of other sort of like, there were plenty of other demerits in the show that I personally identified, but I just think his work is just, it's really like warmed over third rate Basquiat, you know.
Mm-hmm. Or Schnabel, perhaps.
No, there are no sort of like craggy things or build up or, you know, any of that macho posturing.
Mm-hmm.
it's more like Basquiat, you know, and
it's
frankly,
more graphic.
You know, Basquiat's also sort of, Basquiat's also problematic, you know, I mean, I know everyone wants to think he's a genius because that's, you know, that's the legend. He's definitely an interesting artist, but you know, I don't know that he didn't get it by in his own lifetime. I don't know why he should get it by now. But in any event, he's at least an interesting artist and at times a good one. Mourinho is not. He just isn't, you know.
Right.
And it's like I said, it's unfortunate, man.
Yeah. Well, before I forget, you do mention these collectors who got behind him, and in that same conversation I had with that art advisor, you know, who I assume knew such things, I asked her about these collector groups, these investment sort of secret investment groups, and it sounds like you are implying that the Rubels and the Mugrabis and maybe a few others. I wonder to what extent they got together around a conference table and said, "Let's back this guy." And you know, how do you see that kind of phenomenon in the art world going down as a little more organic than that?
Well, it's not much more organic than that. I mean, I don't think they necessarily sit down with lawyers around a single conference table, but they meet at places, you know, they meet at places like, you know, every art fair that we know about. I mean, they meet at places like Miami Basel at specific restaurants or at specific parties. And, and they do sit around and they talk about this. I bought this. What did you see? What did you do? What did, you know, how many? What are the price? What was the discount? You know, and often they'll pick up the phone and they'll call each other. And these things are documented, and they'll basically try and figure out a way to sort of like get something into auction, or to back it at auction, or to, you know, and I know the same conversations happen with institutions.
Yeah.
Now, what happened with the Rubels and Murillo is you know, is pretty clear, and it's also documented. It's out there. You know, they showed up at a studio. Actually, they let him know they were coming to the studio. I don't know where they saw the work. And I think, if I remember correctly, 48 hours he managed to paint 30 paintings.
Oh, my God.
Do you know what I mean? And,
Jesus.
You know, and then they went in and just bought the lot. And then they gave him their warehouse in Miami to do, you know, a first-time residency for them. They'd never done that before with an artist. And basically let him work there for a couple of months. And then he did 50 paintings. And they bought the lot, you know, so they've cornered a market on something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's not the first time the Rubels do this. I mean, the answer to your question is, the question being, you know, do collectors collude amongst themselves to raise prices and raise careers for their own benefit? The answer is absolutely 100% yes. It is absolutely you can document it and verifiable. In fact, I've gotten the emails from collectors. Stupid enough, or at least their PR people, stupid enough to think that I would somehow or other not recognize let me tell you what one of these said, and I actually sort of published it in a voice piece. I got an email from a collector's representative basically bragging about how that particular collector managed to raise the prices and careers of a number of artists.
Wow.
And how important that was, and how he basically created value. I mean, it was literally put in those terms, and that this was a reason I should be, you know, doing a profile of that collector.
So how many different ways did they get wrong what you do?
You know, clearly, whoever it was has never read anything I've written.
Right.
You know, or they read it with, you know, the usual sort of like gloss, you know, name, publication, bingo.
Yeah.
That's the guy. Just ridiculous. Just absolutely ridiculous. So,
wow.
You know, and that is sort of like the dirty secret in our art world, you know, is that, you know, money sort of happens like every generation. You know, you have some Cassandra like critic basically saying this since Robert Hughes, at least, you know, someone's been out there sort of saying this, and it's, but that doesn't make it any less true. You know, the fact is that money matters a lot more in today's art world than it did
sure.
in the 1980s. And it certainly matters a lot more than it did even a decade ago.
Sure.
And I think that's, you know, verifiable in just about every way. Does that mean that's the only thing that matters in the art world? No. And part of the reason that that's not the only thing that matters in the art world is because there's guys like you and me and other people around who are actually interested in art and talking about art. Never mind the artists who are, you know, who are interested in that and are the sort of the prime movers and shakers in production at the very least. So, you know, unfortunately, it's a bigger elephant than it has been in a long time. You know?
Well, let me ask you about the Rebels. I have a limited familiarity, admittedly, with them, but I do understand from reportings that they're extremely passionate about contemporary art and, you know, and what's cooking and what's coming up and whatnot. That's not to give them a pass by any stretch, but I just wonder if that's, you know, rings true with you. And also, say, prior to Oscar Murillo, what you feel like their track record was in terms of who they
not
were showing.
Good.
Yeah.
Not good.
Uh-huh.
You know,
what are some other examples?
Yeah, you know, maybe I should dial up. What was the show I saw? It was the one I saw in Miami, actually. I mean, you know, there's a whole mess of sort of young, hot things that the Rebels go for, and that's always sort of been the case.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah,
they collect at that level, and then they sort of like they build up reputation and prices. Just the work was so damn forgettable. For some reason, looking for them has made my computer crash.
All right. Well, let's leave it at that then.
Okay.
I think you made your point. But and maybe, you know, if we return to the Forever Now show at MoMA, which is still going on, right? It hasn't ended yet?
No.
Okay.
Over.
Okay, good. So we're still on point. But I bet there's some crossover with the Rebels in that show. One thing that...
Oscar Murillo.
Oh, okay, got it, of course. One thing that occurred to me as I was, you know, as I was reading your piece and thinking about the show, which, again, I haven't seen, so I can't be a pundit firsthand, but the fact that your argument is not 100% sound to the extent that Sterling Ruby is not in the show. if you get my joke...
Good point. I do get your joke. You're absolutely right. He is not in the show.
Yeah.
But he's in so many shows. And, you know, they had to leave him out of one.
But the subtext, though, of my point is, would you say that almost to an artist, the works in the show are of incredibly high market value?
I'd say that they get basically frothed up to high market value. That's what I would say. People like, we mentioned Dan Colin, Justin Lowe, you know, there are a lot of other folks. Yeah, and every now and again, you know, they'll find somebody who's good, you know,
mm-hmm.
and collect him early. I mean, you know, they're, even if you have a scattershot approach, then, you know, you'll manage okay. But put it this way, I do not share their aesthetic one bit. You know, it's about flash. It's almost exclusively painting, and I'm a painting guy. You know, but just sort of the easiest kind of attitudinal painting. Did I mention Dan Colin and Justin Lowe? I think I did.
Yeah. They're not in this show, though, right?
What's that?
Neither of them are in this show.
No, not neither of them are.
But they're Rebel people.
Yeah, but Murillo is. Mark Flood, who's a semi-interesting painter, is somebody who I saw at their place,
mm-hmm.
actually, and
mm-hmm.
that was good, you know, that was decent.
Okay,
but it was a large group show. The last thing I saw at their place, put on for Miami Basel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So,
since we're talking about the Rebels and collectors, you know, which obviously play well into the Forever Now show. Who are some collectors that you feel are healthy contributors to the market and to the art conversation?
Well, I mean, I'd say in general, collectors who there is this large group of collectors now who basically build their own institutions, and I understand the rationale for that. But it's long term; it's not a great rationale for the art world, and to the degree that it's not good for institutions or even the art that gets collected. in these private museums. You know, these private museums have no endowments, and they basically sort of exist at the whim of, you know, the individual owners, as it were. And they may not be stewards of the work for a lifetime, and likely not going to, they're not going to be stewards of the work after they pass on, you know, after the work basically is inherited by their wives or you know, their children. So, you know, I guess the first thing I'd say is that, you know, I think a traditional relationship between a collector and a museum is something that should still be, you know, nurtured. And is still, you know, in my mind, you know, the most productive, as it were, ecologically sound model to follow. It works for the benefit of the greater good, and that's obviously, you know, an important thing. Having said that, you know, there are a lot of people out there who have their private institutions who are, you know, good collectors, you know. I think the fellow who's also done in Miami, Marty. Oh,
Jewish guy, obviously. I can't remember his last name either.
Yeah, I can't either. He's, you know, he's a good collector. And for me, he's, you know, an interesting counterpoint to somebody like the Rebels, who seem to be really only about what's hot now. You know, everything seems to have, everything with the Rebels seems to have like a half-life of, you know, a nanosecond. You look away and, you know, those artists don't show up in magazines anymore. And, you know, I think that's, you know, unfortunate.
Well, Christian, since the Broad Museum will be opening in the relative near future out here in Los Angeles, would you like to weigh in on him and that institution?
Well, you know, this is, I guess it's everybody's problem, but it really is you guys' problem. But venture philanthropy sounds like an actual oxymoron to me, not like some clever quip. You know, he's been obviously not exactly a boon for the institutions in your city. So, you know, we'll see what he wants to do with his own money in this, you know, at his new place. I saw construction going on in December. Mm-hmm. And, you know, aside from the fact that it looks real big, I don't know what to say, man. You know, but that's kind of the deal with a lot of collectors these days, you know, whether it's Pinot or Broad, somehow or other, you just have the sense that, you know, all this stuff is just positional. You know, the art is to make a big building. The big building is to make a big statement. And, you know, and the big statement is so that they can, you know, somehow or other, I don't know, continue sort of legitimating their social and economic positions and political positions. You know?
Yeah. So I understand that sort of cynical take on what they're doing ultimately and how they don't maybe have, as you sort of implied earlier, they don't have the longer view. But I just wonder, maybe this is a little naive, but...
Agnes Gund is a good example of somebody else, you know, who I think is a good collector,
mm-hmm.
you know. Jerry Speier, again, both people at the moment, curiously enough, the board I'm beating up on.
Right.
But, you know, neither of them have a personal museum. And Agnes Gunn in particular, you know, has devoted a lifetime to funding and finding funding, you know, for an institution and for artists she cares about. And that's important. You know, that's the other way to do it, you know.
Well, what I was just wondering out loud is if a Broad Museum or a Rubel Museum or another Perez, would this fall under that category as well? If they are, you know, buying this institution and it's just all part of, you know, building their legacy and their ego and what have you, whatever cynical way you want to put it, but they're building a lot of square footage to buy, show, and store a lot of art, that does that not in theory give more opportunity for the museums to bring in other artists that maybe would not otherwise be included?
I see your point. Is it better than buying a baseball team? Yeah, in most cases it is. In some it isn't.
Okay.
And you know, at that point, you just have to go on a sort of case by case basis.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, the fact is that, you know, instead of yachts, like, rich people now want to buy art, and, you know, and then exponentially, sort of like the ambitions grow from there.
Right.
And you know, once you have that happen, you know, once you have that happen, you start thinking about, or you want these folks to start thinking about values that are sort of inherent in the art rather than extraneous to it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, because essentially they're going to be stewards of that stuff.
Yeah.
And fortunately or unfortunately, that's my job. That's part of my job description, is to remind people that that's what they should be asking for, you know. Now, does this mean that, like, everyone who does this is some kind of shitbag and is only looking out for their own interests? No, clearly not. You know, I mean, you know, we need to sort of have a subtle reading of this, in that even folks like the rebels, who I would argue are largely motivated, I would never contradict them in saying that they are not passionate about art.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I would say that they are equally passionate about the kind of social positioning that art gives them.
Right.
And also about inflating certain kinds of monetary financial values in art that, that I find to be totally extraneous to art itself.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, there was a guy who I met, what's his name? In fact, he had been the curator for the Rebels, come to think of it. What's his name? Who then went on to build a collection. He's building a collection now for a fellow named Mr. Zeitz, who's the head of Puma, the company, the sneaker company,
right,
and clothing company. And they're building, I think it's like $173 million museum in Johannesburg, and buying lots and lots of work. And the quality of the work, from what I've gathered and seeing at least one slide presentation that this curator sort of put together, you know, is sort of head and shoulders above what I've seen at the Rebels. And that already tells me that I'm far more interested in that particular project, in which that was in Miami, than what they've got.
Yeah.
You know, and this is also intended to be sort of a public museum.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I guess, but, you know, but since we brought it up at the beginning, and I know that you've written a lot about, devote a lot of time to it and passion to it, that we would be remiss if we didn't talk about Cuba and Miss Bruguera. So I guess the most recent thing you're writing about is this fair, Havana Fair.
Well, the biennial.
The biennial, sorry. The Havana Biennial, which is coming up just this weekend. Are you going to be going?
Opens tomorrow.
Are you going?
You know what? I'm not going. There was some discussion that I might go, but, you know, right now I have a 12-year-old boy. My wife's in Asia for the next week and a half, so I won't be making it to the opening, at least. Maybe I'll go after. If they let me in. You know, I've been to Havana four times before, but I'm very cognizant of the fact that, having written negatively about the biennial and having identified people by name as a director of the biennial,
they might have your name on.
No, I know for a fact that that's true.
You're on the do not board list.
Well, don't know. I don't know that for a fact. I would try to go, but I wouldn't be surprised if that's the case.
Right.
You know.
Well, let's try drawing a little through line from the fact that this biennial is hounded by countering Ms. Bruguera and Biesenbach, who we talked about earlier, and the sort of things that he was avoiding. So, you know, the kowtowing that he's doing, and then the kowtowing that the people involved in this biennial are doing. Take it wherever you like.
Well, you know, there's a lot of conformism going on in the art world these days, and part of it, like I said, is oriented towards, In the global north, as it were, in sort of the collecting north and the art world north, that has everything to do with money and celebrity, right?
Mm-hmm,
you mentioned fashion, but I'd lump fashion in with celebrity as well.
Sure.
I think they basically, you know, live in the same arena.
Mm-hmm.
In the global south, you know, these issues, they're not the issues play out differently because the poles of power are different. And, you know, in a place like Cuba, you're actually worried about what the government thinks. In a place like Egypt, you're worried about what the government thinks. Mm-hmm. Never mind a place like Syria, you know, or what people with guns think. You know, so things are riskier at a personal level. And because of that, you know, sometimes you expect, because the bet is bigger personally, you expect people in from all walks of life to basically sort of take that into account. It happens that you know, often people from the north don't quite recognize the difference in the settings, and frankly, even when they do, they still behave in very sort of convenient and sometimes, you know, very selfish ways. There's a great quote that I collect quotes every now and again, and I came across one that it sort of is in my collection to send to somebody today when I was trying to explain something about, I was trying to explain Tanya's situation to them. And it's a Susan Sontag quote. It's 10% of the population is cruel no matter what, and 10% is merciful no matter what, and the remaining 80% can be moved in either direction. And that seems to be super true,
yeah,
you know, about the situation both at here, you know, again, in the global north, in places like New York City or Los Angeles, where, you know, folks are basically trying to figure out where to go. You know, there are a lot of undecided people, as there always are. And the pole stars are, you know, money and fame. And in a place like Cuba, clearly it's political power and money.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And, you know, you got a lot of people buckling under to that who should know better, you know, who are coming from here and going there. And it's pretty shocking. She, you know, a lot of people have turned their back on her that were close collaborators. And folks who, you know, I'm pained, I think, to learn, would take a bit of advantage, a small bit of advantage, you know, over, you know, helping her out, or better yet, doing something on principle. And mm-hmm. that principle being that, like, you know, you have to draw some kind of line under, you know, the idea of not free speech. You know,
yeah.
If you don't, it's the basic foundational principle of art making, among other things.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't have it, then, you know, everything else, every other discussion that happens is largely nullified, you know, made absurd. But, you know, that's sort of the period we live in. On the other hand, there are a number of people who've really supported her and who have been out there sort of beating the bushes and trying to help her out. So it's not all doom and gloom, man. I mean, you know, she's got a network of folks both there and here. Now, I'd say having a network there is much harder because, you know, you make a decision to help someone like Tanya Bergara out, a professional, you're dead, you know.
Right.
Worse.
Well, that's, you know? That. Speaking of which, you know, you mentioned in your piece the artist Alexis Lavea Machado.
Cacho.
So yeah. That's his alias. So, first of all, would you consider him the equivalent of like a court painter? You know,
at this point, I would.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
At this point, I would.
And you also and along that line, you as far as not only whether he would volunteer to be available, but you mentioned that Bruguera herself reached out repeatedly to him.
Yes.
You know, as a representative of the National Assembly, but he did not respond. So, I mean, but then you just a moment ago, you did mention that aligning yourself with her is a very dangerous move. So, and that's, to what degree do you sympathize with him in that regard?
Well, you know, honestly, I think with him it's a little different. I mean, you know, he's Fidel's favorite artist. He's somebody who went with Raul Castro to visit the Vatican and gave, you know, Pope Francis a painting. You know, he's a guy who's basically in the corridors of power. He's actually a deputy of the National Assembly.
Wow.
If anyone has the possibility to actually sort of like say something publicly, never mind privately, it's him, you know, without fear of tremendous repercussions.
Right.
You know, and his situation is not too dissimilar from that of other people in similarly repressive societies. I mean, China is not unlike Cuba in that respect. In fact, far worse, I would say. You know, I mean, the Chinese situation is crazy. There's this topsy-turvy sort of like, you know, big money art world with, there is one big dissident artist, there are many more, at Ai Weiwei. And, you know, and another artist who sort of came up the same generation as he did, Xu Bing, who essentially occupies almost the same role as Cacho does in Cuba. You know, Xu Bing is, if I remember correctly, the director of the National Academy in Beijing. Uh-huh. And as such, you know, has a real official role. And, you know, he doesn't, as far as I know, occupy, have real political power. But he has a lot of power sort of within the art world that could be said to be political. Yeah, to my knowledge, he's not exactly done much for I, or other people who are, you know, who've not done well by the Chinese communist regime.
Would you say that Cacho is being a coward, or even worse, is he just being indifferent?
I think it's in the even worse category.
Mm.
You know?
Huh. So, I mean, put yourself in his head. What is he, why is he, he's not responding to her requests. He knows this is going on. What's going through his head? Can you even imagine?
Look, yeah, I can imagine, because these are not issues that are new to the art world. You know, these same issues came about, or similar situations came about, you know, in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s, and 50s, and 60s. You know, Neruda was a fantastic poet, but you know, a shitty art politician. you know, some people say he gave up Trotsky in Mexico City. The motivations are power. You know, the motivations are. That's the motivation. That's the main motivation.
Yeah, yeah.
Power, well, privilege. The same motivations as everybody else.
Yeah.
I mean, it's no different in, you know, in our trade than it is in any other trade.
Yeah.
And when you have doctors or lawyers or doctors' organizations or lawyerly organizations or art schools in an authoritarian context as opposed to a democratic one, you know, you get real distortions, and you know, those distortions are all about power and influence and privilege. And that's what happens in Cuba and in China today. And you know, you have people who, you know, are important artists. I mean, Cacho and Xu Bing are important artists.
Mm-hmm.
Who hold a disproportionate amount of influence over, you know, what their peers do, and you know, sometimes they exercise that to good benefit, like Cacho did, for example. Apparently, this year, he took money out of his own pocket and created a Wi-Fi station somewhere in Havana. I've not seen it because it's new, but that's huge in Havana,
yeah.
Since Cuba apparently is, you know, hemispherically the least covered country. The least internet has the least internet coverage of any country in the hemisphere.
Right,
and that's massive. And he did it with his own money, and you know that's important. But you know, it's equally important, or even more important, to determining not just Tanya's fate, but the fate of you know, free expression in a place like Cuba and the future of the arts in Cuba to take up, you know, this cause and help her out.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, unless there's anything else that you feel like we should get to, even if briefly, I thought we would wrap up actually with a new dichotomy that new for me anyway, and maybe admittedly perhaps a little simplistic, but at this Paris Photo LA, I ran to this curator who referred to my friend as a bridge as opposed to a fortress, and it's kind of become this new lens that I'm using, you know, towards the art world. And I'm just curious to know what your associations might be, you know, with people who are fortresses as opposed to bridges, or bridges as opposed to fortresses. And I understand that, like, when we go back to the beginning of the conversation, we were talking about social media, that if you were on Facebook, that could be, get a little ugly for you in terms of, you know, the kind of solicitations that you might get, and in which case you would need to become a fortress. But maybe somehow through your research and what have you, you see the dark sides of fortresses and how that kind of scenario plays out. Is this bringing up any associations?
Well, you know, it's an interesting dichotomy, so I'll play along. I mean, the thing about power is that clearly it sort of like lives better in a fortress than it does in a bridge, because, you know, the bridge is open and
yeah,
everyone can see what's happening, and
right,
fortresses by definition are basically sort of like shut off from the outside.
Right.
So all kinds of things can happen in you know, within their precincts. You know, I guess what I'd say is that, you know, transparency is an important thing. It's definitely an important thing in the art world. It's increasingly important to the degree that art becomes financialized. You know, we're at a point where, you know, the whole commodity structure argument has actually been supplanted by a financial argument. You know, art is now kind of fully financialized, at least to a certain strata. That means it trades like Microsoft and Microsoft stocks. You know, and that's a different question from it being a Louis Vuitton bag, like a Louis Vuitton bag. In pointing out that distinction, you know, what I mean to say is that art can't be, to the degree that it's financialized, it can't be a safe haven for laissez-faire capitalism. You know, it can't be one of these tax-free zones, hidden away from regulation, hidden away from other interests, hidden away from critical eyes, because we all know what's going to happen if it works, if that's what happens to it. You know, we all know it's not going to, it's going to get messy, it's going to get dirty, terrible things are going to happen, and it's going to be bad for everybody, because that's the way it always works out.
Yeah.
You know, the track record on laissez-faire capitalism is not great. It's brutal. It's nasty. It's foul. You know, it in the end, it benefits a very few, and it fucks everybody else. So,
kind of what's going on right now.
Yeah, it's totally a lot like what's going on right now. So in your terms, yeah, I'm all for bridges. I'm all for bridges. And at this point, I'm very much against fortresses.
Good.
You know, we need to bust some windows in there, just so we can have some idea, just so the air can get out and we can at least get some notion of what's going on.
Beautiful. Yeah, let's get a little air going. That sounds like a plan.
All right, man.
Great to talk, Christian. Thanks so much
again. You too, Michael. Thank you.
Take
care.
Be
well now. Bye-bye.
And we're out. Thank you very much again to Christian for coming back on the show. Now, why do you think that the Christian Viveros Phone A episode, as we discussed, has been the most popular podcast, the last one, and hopefully this one as well? Well, obviously, it was, as we discussed, he does not have a big social media presence. So my theory now is that, because Christian tells it like it is, no bullshit, he is coming from a place of where he needs to be diplomatic to a certain extent, but he's also able to be honest. So I think that's what it is. No bullshit, tells it like it is. All right, thank you very much for being here. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope to hear from you, and I will talk to you soon.